everyone. Thanks for tuning into The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, you can subscribe or follow us on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcast platforms. To stay up to date with episodes, upcoming articles, and to get to know The Collective better, please like our Facebook page, The Collective Perspective, and Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast. Reviews are always welcome, and please leave comments or questions, as well as send us an email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Welcome again, everyone, to Episode 7, Reclaiming and Reshaping Higher Education. My name is Ana Sofia, and I'll have the other hosts also introduce themselves. Let's go around and each say our name, pronouns, theater disciplines, and where you're currently residing. And then for a check-in question, I'll ask, who is a mentor or teacher in higher education that you would like to honor or who has played an important role in your life?
I can go first. My name is Cambria Herrera, and I am a director. My pronouns are she, her, and they, them. And I'm currently studying for my MFA at UC San Diego. And I am currently on the lands of the Kumeyaay people. And in addition to honoring the Kumeyaay people, I would like to honor my current professor and mentor, Vanessa Stalling. She is an incredible person and educator and mentor to me in empowering me to be myself in my creative process and in my work in a way that I have never experienced before. And I would just like to send a special shout out to her influencing my perspectives today.
All right, I guess I'm up. My name is Tia Jemison. I go by any pronoun, including bitch, if used with respect. I'm an actor, I'm a singer, I'm a saxophonist, I'm an educator, I'm a director, I'm a writer. I wear many hats. I would like to acknowledge Dr. Deborah Plant, who was my first mentor in undergrad, who is also a scholar for Zora Neale Hurston. And I just have to acknowledge her because she taught me about my Blackness. Mm. She allowed space for me to understand how amazing I was within my Blackness, and I had never been given that opportunity before in education. That's all.
And I'm Ana Sofia Villanueva. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a theater producer, director, writer, and activist, currently residing on traditional unceded Yakima land in central Washington. And well, to be honest, I haven't had a mentor inside or outside of higher education. And that's something I used to feel somewhat embarrassed about, as if I was lacking in talent or I didn't deserve one. But as I've come to learn that jobs and opportunities and mentorship in this industry is very much tied to who you know, or someone in a more established position or position of power seeing themselves reflected in you or your craft and taking you under their wing, it's no wonder I didn't have a mentor. And especially in directing, where it's so dominated by men and white folks who buy into racist ideology, like believing that we live in a meritocratic society, or racist stereotypes such as the docile Asian American woman, or the angry Black woman, or the fiery Latina, and so on, it's no wonder they don't see themselves reflected in us. A truism I've heard is, women of color do not get mentors. We are the mentors. And that's obviously not always true, but it's certainly been my experience. So, but even with that, you know, reality of no mentor per se, I do want to honor a former teacher of mine, Matt Foss. Matt was the first and maybe even the only teacher to really see me. As an older, untraditional student in a predominantly white and middle and upper class university, I felt very insecure about my ability and place within the department. But he was confident that my work experience and my strong desire to learn, you know, if you've ever been locked out of education, the ability to spend your time learning from the great minds is like the ultimate privilege. So yeah, he didn't let my unconventional path hold me back, and he let me be part of graduate level courses and introduced me to Peter Brook and Augusto Boal and deepened my love of Shakespeare and let me cry during his office hours when I was overwhelmed. And more than anything, he inspired me to pave my own way. Did that through his teaching, but also in this beautiful and honest production of The Glass Menagerie, that he did outside of the university in this small restaurant, and it was truly transformative. I left that production changed. It was the moment where I decided I would no longer wait to be seen by the white men in charge or wait to be given an opportunity that was likely never to come. It was also the night I first relapsed and broke a 2-year stint of sobriety, which, you know, is interesting as people think that only happens with tragedy. Though currently over 2.5 years sober with a better program in place, so no cause for alarm. But anyways, it's when I began producing and directing productions outside of the department, or at least outside of their permission, with plays that centered on identities and narratives that were authentic to me and actually meaningful. Still to this day, some of my favorite plays I've directed were from that time, that rare moment in my career where I was able to, as Lapika Shaw put it in a previous episode, fail upwards. And I got to experiment with form and attempt decolonial practices and anti-patriarchal approaches and basically figure out how to put my values into practice. So thank you, Matt Foss, my friend. All right. So for today's episode, we are talking about the article Training Theater Students of Color in the United States by Kaja Dunn, Cheryl D. Luckett, and Daphne Sigre. The article is part of a special issue of the journal Theater, Dance, and Performance Training, Pushing Against the Canon, Volume 11, Issue 3, and published in 2020. We will be sure to provide an accessible link on our Facebook page. As it is a scholarly article, which is fitting since we are talking about higher education today, I will go ahead and read the short abstract provided. Kaja Dunn, Cheryl D. Luckett, and Daphne Sigre are U.S. theater professors whose current research investigates underrepresented ways of training theater students. Specifically, their work advocates for diverse training approaches to teaching acting. In this conversational essay, Dunn, Luckett, and Sigre illuminate many issues pertaining to U.S. actor training programs in hopes that generative parallels and intersections with their work can be made with allies engaged in similar work abroad. They begin by introducing themselves. Again, we'll make their listed bios available on our Facebook page. And then the professors move into the conversation by first defining the term students of color and how that identity marker is both helpful and harmful. So let's start there as well. Students of color, what are your thoughts about their responses or your own perspective on the term?
Yeah, I appreciated this discussion because it made me think about how do I define this term for myself very explicitly and put it into words. And I define Black and Indigenous person of color as people who are perceived as non-white and therefore susceptible to the current and historical oppression that occurs in our society. And I do recognize that this really centers whiteness, that this centers the white experience and the white perspective and gaze. So I do appreciate how the term has developed to start with Black and Indigenous folks. And I originally really took comfort in the term because I am a mixed race person. So when people talk about Latinx folks, a lot of times I don't like fully fit into that category that people are talking about. Or when people talk about Chicanx folks, like I don't particularly fit into everything that's being said about that monolith. So I appreciate the term people of color and Black and Indigenous people of color because it resonates more with what people are usually trying to say and how I have lived experience in my skin.
And to clarify there, you're talking about the term BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, yeah. and people of color.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did think that was interesting here because they actually use the term people of color, POC,
right.
Which is an older terminology, which I thought was interesting given that this article was written only a year ago. But I wondered if that perhaps had to do with that they were wanting to connect with folks globally. And yeah, I feel very similarly to you, Cambria. Like, while I appreciate the recognition of, speaking of the term BIPOC, recognition of Black and Indigenous folks in the formation of this country, the term BIPOC to me inadvertently creates a hierarchy where it assumes other folks did not also contribute to this country or that we just did, you know, that contribution more recently. And it assumes these groups are monolith, like you said, as if someone cannot be both Black and Indigenous, or as Daphne Sigre points out, some folks, like you said, Latinxes can be Black, Indigenous, white, Asian, and or mixed race.
I don't like it.
Love it. Tell me more.
For literally all the reasons you all are talking about, because it does. It centers whiteness. It turns everyone else into an other. And like you said, we because of the slave trade and everything else, we are complex human beings when it comes to this whole quotations race. Because, you know, there is no such thing as race. We're all just human, but it separates us even more. It just separates us, you know. Okay, so like you said, okay, so I either have to be Black or Indigenous, or I'm a person of color. I can't really be all of them. Then what am I? What am I if I am Black and Indigenous? So I'm just bi. I've never liked the term person of color. You know, that was just another way of saying nigger. And then now it's just like, here we are adding this BI. Okay, now POC, we're going to throw everybody into this POC, and then Black and Indigenous is, it's just all trash in a way of separation, in a way of just bringing white to the forefront and putting it, like you said, putting it on top. And no.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Tia. POC, people of color, was often used by white folks, though not exclusively by white folks, as a more palatable version of Black folks in the past. So I do like that distinction with BIPOC.
I was reading there's been a lot of stuff going around, a lot of sites of the global majority.
Yes.
I know you had to have seen it. It's everywhere now. And I'm like, yeah, because literally we are the global majority. It's not whiteness. Whiteness is not the global majority. It's not, you know, if you watch the opening of the Olympics, it's a whole bunch of different melanated people, you know, they're all melanaceous, different, you know, it's not whiteness. It's not.
But there is something about BIPOC, and again, similar to Latinx, that is problematic, but still specific to the US. And in the not too distant future, we will be the majority in the States. So for now, as a placeholder, I will use BIPOC as well as people of the global majority. Yeah, cool. So then the professors went into pushing back on the canon and called for teaching against the canon and for cultural competency.
Oh man, it reminds me actually of when I was at DePaul and we had the, what's it called, VASTA. It's the voice. All the voice teachers come to a school and they do a bunch of workshops. But we had it at DePaul while I was in grad school, and UCSD came. They came and their actors came via satellite. And this was even, you know, it wasn't COVID or anything, but the lady, I don't know her name, she put them up satellite, and they were Black actors. And they talked about how they were not able to do stuff that was culturally appropriate for them. They weren't able to do the August Wilson stuff. They weren't able to do that. And they talked about how it was not fair, and that their white counterparts, their other white classmates, should have to do August Wilson pieces since they have to do, you know, the Chekhov pieces. And it was like a whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I was there with one of my acting teachers, and we actually did that at DePaul. In my class, white students had to do August Wilson. I did a Fences scene with a white dude. Like, I did that scene from Fences because it was like, well, I mean, those actors opened up eyes of like, hey, yeah, this isn't fair. I have to do all this white stuff. And, you know, you don't ever have to try to even do any research about my culture. But now, since you have to do this August Wilson play, all the white classmates had to go do the research. They had to see what it was like in that time period for Black people. Like, they actually had to try to take on something else, which was so hard for them. Of course it was. But still, I have to do it as a Black student in any university. And no one's going to really cast me as that stuff. I'm learning this stuff, but who's really, you know, people, who's going to cast me as that stuff? I'm going to be cast in stuff that's culturally appropriate for me. I'm going to be cast in the August Wilson stuff, you know? So it takes me back to that, because those actors, I mean, I was happy that our teacher was willing to do it. And I'm sure they haven't done it since, you know, like, we were the only class that did that. But we did that. We did that. And I wish that stuff like that happened more, because it's sad to hear that actors can go to such prestigious schools and never work on anything that they can identify with. Mm-hmm. They never work on anything that's for them, written for them, for their bodies in space. And that's horrible. It's just horrible.
Very true. I really love that you did that with your students. I also really love that this article, someone specifically said that teaching against the canon leads to smart cultural competence. And that's one, I love the word against the canon, because I say push back against it completely. And it can only serve us all. We can all only grow from receiving more cultural experiences and not just building a new canon of these are the texts that we have to keep talking about and keep teaching. We have to talk about August Wilson and Lorca, like these are the canons. No, I think culture changes. We're in a pandemic time. So what are the pieces from around the world that are speaking to us in the time that we're in? And what are people liking right now? What is challenging folks right now? That is what I think should be performed and worked on in schools, and so that, yes, we can all grow. We're in a growing environment. I also think the ideas of standards, professional theater standards, and best practices that were brought up in the article are all trash. I think those are all things we need to push against. There shouldn't be any canon. There shouldn't be any standard when it comes to how to teach art.
I agree. Yes.
I'm not sure what they mean exactly when they say teaching against the canon. It's a phrase that I've heard a lot, but they don't fully explain what that means. It sounds like, and let me know if I'm missing it, but it sounds like they're taking that in the article to mean expanding the canon.
Yeah, maybe. I took it as like, let's blow it up. Like, maybe we'll approach those sometimes, but let's put more of our energy into new types of shows that haven't been produced and read over and over again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because it's the same place. All the schools, we're all doing the same stuff. If we do something Black, it is August Wilson. But that doesn't, you know, to hear that didn't even happen at some schools was just like, wait, y'all don't even do August Wilson? Like, okay. We haven't made it to Katori Hall and Dominique Morceau and people like that, you know, Donja Love. We haven't made it to them, but you're not even doing August Wilson, you know? So I think pushing against the canon, just forget all that stuff. Like, we're sick of Stanislavski. And I think it said it somewhere in that art, you know, in the article of like, no, like, stop, just stop. Cause there's just new ways of communicating. Just like there's new plays that speak to us now. You were just saying it, you know, and that's important for us to do stuff that's now, that's for us now.
Although I do have to say, though, that expansion of the canon, it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be contemporary. I mean, there's this mindset that if we expand that and that we go beyond white folks, that it can only mean contemporary. And that's not true. The global majority, are you kidding me? We've been here. And there have been so many great plays. There's actually a document I've come across. It's called Alternative Canon. I'll also put that on the Facebook page. But it looks at alternatives to the canon. And I really like that. I'll share that with everybody. Because no, it doesn't mean that we just have to do contemporary. And I, you know, for me, I don't know that I feel the same way. I don't think we should cancel the entire canon. Much of it is still relevant and important. However, I do think it's okay to let go of or no longer produce plays that have a long history of oppression, exploitation, and misrepresentation from the community it's supposedly representing, such as Miss Saigon, Porgy and Bess, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and West Side Story. We don't need to be producing work for the sake of white people's nostalgia at the expense of marginalized populations.
Come on.
And yes, I'm aware that I just said all musicals, but, you know, so maybe that's a whole nother episode of like musical theater world, because they're in some trouble. That those are the ones that are so readily.
Yeah, that's the stuff that sells. That's the stuff that they keep doing. Yeah. Everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I keep pushing back on this idea of cancellation because to me, I feel like it needs to be expansion. Because for me, the issue is an overrepresentation of white stories and what is being determined as the canon and what constitutes a universal story. Kind of like how Daphne Segre talked about it, how they had non-Black Latinx students who found John Leguizamo's solo performance to be universal.
I personally am not a fan of his work, although I did think he was really sexy to bolt back in the night.
Oh yeah. In that Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, I'm aware that I just aged myself there too.
Hey, I aged myself too.
Right? But anyways, Sigrid also said that a white man in the classroom didn't think that same performance was universal because Leguizamo's experiences were so far removed from his own. And I think that's a great example of how often universal is used through the white lens and sets whiteness as the standard or universal norm.
Yeah.
Whereas BIPOCs, we have had no choice but to find that universality in white narratives.
Yeah.
Such as a Rican being incredibly moved by the glass menagerie. You know?
Yes.
But switching back to the conversation on cultural competency.
There's something in there that isn't sitting right with me. So I think I'm going to process this with you. Overall, I agree that there should be more cultural competency in the classroom. I mean, professors should do prep work that extends beyond white students and expand their repertoire to include textbooks, training methods, and plays written by BIPOC for BIPOC students. And it's also important for BIPOCs to portray roles that were written for them or where they embody many of the same identities as their characters. But there's something in the way that Daphne Sigrid is describing cultural competency that I think that I'm trying to process right now. Sigrid wrote, "My Asian American student was so happy to be in a role that was reflective of her culture." I think that's in a good direction, but I also think it needs to be unpacked further because Asian American is not a singular culture. You can't look at someone and know which culture and identities are authentic to them, nor is it okay to unilaterally decide which identity a person holds is most important. For example, I had an amazing white acting teacher who was, you know, simultaneously empathetic and profoundly racist, as is often the case. And, you know, she suggested some monologues for me, including Cleopatra and one of the characters from The Motherfucker with the Hat, to exotified roles for the curvy, spicy Latina. And when I hesitated, my teacher quickly explained that the character was Puerto Rican. Now, don't get me wrong. I appreciate that she didn't suggest the monologue because the character was Latina or worse, Hispanic. But she was still deciding the most important criteria for me was my perceived racial identity. She didn't pick the character because she felt like it would bring out the most from my acting. She picked it based on her own preconceived notions and with nothing to do with my self-identity. So there's an underlying assumption here that cultural competency is an attainable thing that you will know once you have accomplished it, that it is achieved through casting actors in roles that are descriptive of their perceived identity, such as assuming that an Asian American student would identify with the character for being Asian American, despite that not being a monolith, or maybe they simply don't connect with that character.
Yeah.
So while greater cultural competency is important, maybe there's a way that the students and maybe even professional actors as well can have more agency in the roles they are cast in and which aspects of their complicated and likely intersectional identities they want prioritized when portraying a character.
Yes. All of that. That's so important in schools. It's so important. I mean, hey, you know what I played my final show at DePaul? I was Bernarda Alba. Like, why? I'm Black. But because I'm a strong individual, I was the strongest actor, you know, to play the role because I'm feisty and I'm fierce. I'm an Aries. So it was like, oh, well, you know, for my white director, of course, you know, oh, well, she needs to be Bernarda Alba. Like, no, why do I need to, for what? I'm just because I command space and I have a big presence, you know, and I even went to the faculty. I was like, I should not be playing this. Like, don't cast me as this. Don't. They still cast me as it. you know, and then it was just great. Our first day of rehearsal, the director, who's, you know, white and privileged as hell, he's like, yeah, you know, I cast all of you ladies. And, you know, it's all women in Benanada Alba. It's all women. And he got, I mean, we're everything. He did get everything. We've got the whole BIPOC canon. But first day of rehearsal, he's like, you know, I picked all of you all because we're all immigrants and it's a great country. And we all came here. We're immigrants. I waited till he finished. I waited till, and then after I went up to him and I said, you know, this is the problem because I'm not an immigrant. I come from stolen people. Mm-hmm. Like I come from stolen people, you know, and it's just there are those things, because that's a problem that I also have with a lot of grad programs. They'll give the director so much power, over what's happening with my body. Because like, why did I play Bernadette Alba?
Yeah. Why? I just have to say too, that slogan of like, we're a country of immigrants. It's like, how are you kidding me? That's not true. You do know that, right? Like, do you know how this country was formed, right?
No, obviously not.
Do you know who you are erasing right now? What about Native folks? You know, the people that were here before your ancestors, the colonizers? That's, oh.
It's rough. Yeah. It's hard being brown in the university setting, you know. I mean, it's hard being brown, period, but especially going to school, you know, when they're talking about the canon, what you should do. I mean, because I was just like, there's no way they're going to cast me as this. And they totally did. My name was totally on the cast sheet. I was like, this is, everything about this is wrong. Yeah. And I have to do it because I have no agency and I'll get a bad grade. You know, like I have to play this part. I have to, because I will graduate with distinction with this MFA, mm-hmm. you know. So, yeah, now I'm triggered.
That play is a sore spot for me, too, because my undergrad produced that play and I auditioned and I didn't get in and I had to watch 10 white girls do that play. Yeah.
I mean, you know. My other problem with that play was the fact that everything I had been in grad school was just exploited oppression. Mm-hmm. That play even exploits oppression. I mean, I played a slave. I did Trouble in Mind by Alice Schulz, which is just about racism. I was able to do Wig Out, mm-hmm. which was, but still that even was about the pain in the trans community and the drag community. So. And then Benanada Alba, where I'm like hitting my daughters with sticks. And you know what I'm saying? Like, I was just like, so this is it. This is what I do here in grad school. You just exploit me for my pain. Like literally, which is why when it came to senior show, I was like, yo, I'm doing a one woman show. I'm going to be celebrated since I spent all this money to come here, you know? And that's when I developed my one woman show. Because sometimes we have to take back what's ours, and we shouldn't have to do that in the educational system. You know, our professors should be laying this. You know, they should, like you were saying, they should be talking to us. Like, what do you want to do? How do you identify? Because like you said, you didn't identify with that shit from motherfucker with the hat. Yeah, that's a whole other thing. You know, it's a whole other thing.
Well, to be honest, I really love that role and I really love Cleopatra and... Don't assume.
The sad thing is it was probably the only role that they knew with the Puerto Rican, you know, because it's so popular. They're like, oh, she's perfect for this. It's the one Puerto Rican role here.
Right. Written by a white man. Thank you.
Yep.
Natalie Gierges. Although big fan, but come on.
Yeah. Oh, I was very interested in the tear technology of the soul technique that was brought up in the article, specifically for serving folk in mitigating the trauma that Black folks are continuing to ask to play on stage. And I was like, wow, this exists. I'm so glad this was brought up in this article. I definitely want to research that more. I also really appreciate what you're advocating for, Ana Sofia, in agency. They're so lacking agency in American theater for actors and specifically in academia. I have so many feelings about just the fact that auditioning is the only like job interview type of situation where the auditionee doesn't get to ask any questions. when they're being hired for something? Why are we treating actors as if they're some special species that just fit into anything and don't get to ask questions, don't get to investigate what they're signing up for? And that's even bigger of a problem in academia, where there's power dynamics, there's a grade, there's a degree you're going after. How are people supposed to succeed and feel empowered and grow? And those are like the things you're supposed to be doing there. That's how you become a better artist. But you can't when you're just being shoved into boxes left and right.
Yes. I hear you. I recently directed at the University of Minnesota, the Guthrie BFA program, and I've gotten to direct with them a couple times and hope/plan to again. And I'll start by saying it has been the highlight of my career. Hmm. I absolutely love working with young adults. They're so, they're ready to just try stuff and play and, you know, really break down barriers. And I learned so much. Everyone over 30 should have a mentor under 30. Mm-hmm. So maybe I have had mentors. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been really wonderful. And, the last thing I did with the Guthrie BFA program was directed the show The Heresy of Love by Helen Edmondson. It was a Zoom show, and I really enjoyed the process, even as a Zoom show. And the play, with almost all Spanish characters, was portrayed predominantly by white students. And the play selection and casting choice that was explained to me by the program director, who is a Black man who I greatly admire and think is doing really important work with the department, as well as a Latina instructor, felt that it was an appropriate selection because the play centered Spaniards during the time of colonial Spain. I feel like that was a simplification of what it means to be Latinx in this country and somewhat problematic to associate Spaniards with whiteness. But I also felt like I was the right one to direct it and that we could do some good with it. Still, a lot of the students didn't feel good about taking on roles that they felt should be going to Latinx actors. And they were very upset with the department. While I gave them the space to say that and process that, I also wanted them to know that we chose this, that yes, there were grades being held against them and there would be serious ramifications for not taking these roles, but ultimately it's their choice. They chose to accept the role. I chose to direct it. I didn't cast it. That's not how their program works, but still. And I do think that there is something in there about agency. While actors tend to have the least amount of power, there's not only a lot of actors, but we can't do theater without them.
And school productions or school in general can't happen without the students. They do have a lot of power.
And the thing about hegemony, the ideological dominance of one group over another, is that it requires consent. And the idea that we have in our minds that actors have no power is a kind of consent, because really, they do.
That's real. That's real.
But in shifting from what the students or actors can do, let's talk about ways in which teachers can make change. In the article, the professors share techniques to decolonize the classroom, such as teaching Black acting methods, critical approaches, the Hendricks method, theater of the oppressed, and decodification. So what are some of your thoughts or techniques or approaches that you have experienced or implemented?
Ooh, I love decodification. Like, let's talk about what things mean. It's so helpful because everyone has different word association. And especially when you get into like higher ed, MFA, PhD, the longer you go, the longer you've been in school, the more you've collected information about what words mean. And it's just so valuable to break it down, and so valuable for accessibility, right? Because I'm constantly looking words up that my professors or my classmates say, because I haven't had the same exposure to the vocabulary that they have in my lived experience. So I really appreciate that highlight of that work. It is work, absolutely, to decodify, but I think it's definitely work that is worth putting time into.
At first, I thought when I think that was Kaja Dunn who talks about decodification. At first, I thought they were talking about code switching, like don't code switch, and I was like, what? yeah, but then I realized that Dunn meant defining terms instead of making assumptions, which is like such a simple concept, but it's so powerful. I mean, just starting this conversation with like, we all throw around BIPOC. What does this mean? Let's get on a shared language so we aren't making an assumptions. You know, instead of just saying, we say BIPOC now because we say BIPOC now. It's just the new thing. You know, it's good to know why you're saying it and, you know, like when not to use it, i.e. when there's no Indigenous folks in your group. You don't get to capitalize on the I while simultaneously erasing indigeneity. Just, you know. So I love that approach. I think that one's really, really important.
I agree. I have to look this stuff up. I didn't know the Freddie Hendrick and then the Tier Technology of Soul. Like, I'm so excited to buy this stuff all of this stuff. But Bowow, I've definitely done Bowow, Theater of the Oppressed. We did a lot. We did a lot in undergrad. We didn't do any of that in grad school when I think about it. We didn't really talk about Bowow. Which is interesting. But we talked to a lot in undergrad. I mean, I always liked Bowow. I did. I can't really say I guess I use some stuff. I don't know. I'm one of those professors. It's a mashup. I just want to keep people safe. Mm-hmm. That's probably my main thing is keeping people safe. Because it's just theater has been really unsafe for me. Mm-hmm. You know, even at times when I didn't realize it was unsafe. It's like I got older and I was like, you know, so that's one of my main things, celebrating my students and keeping them safe throughout whatever method. But yeah, I can't wait to look this stuff up and like learn it. I can't, you know, reading this article, I was like, oh snap, we're actually developing things for brown people, for black people. Fuck yeah. Like, yes, I didn't even know this was happening. Where have I been? I've been in a hole with this whiteness. So I'm excited to learn this stuff. I really am.
Yeah, the Black Acting Methods Critical Approaches by Tia M. Schaefer and Cheryl D. Luckett, who is one of the authors of this article we're talking about. I believe it's a top-selling acting training book. And spoiler alert, it's not just for Black folks. Augusta Boal, I you know, was introduced in undergrad, but I didn't really realize that I was using a lot of those techniques, similar to you, a mashup. You know, I've stitched together what I have been able to observe of the men directing over the years. And I found out from assistant directors, they're like, oh, I really like how you use so much of the Theater of the Oppressed. And I'm like, oh, I do?
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, important. And I think those books should be, and those methodologies need to be a standard mm-hmm. for acting curriculum, as well as the practice of decodification.
Come on.
Yep. Can I ask Tia, like, what are some techniques and practices that you do in terms of cultivating a safe space?
Well, we talk a lot. I have this, I was telling y'all earlier, my one class, it's literally like a counseling session. We talk a lot and we talk about, you know, boundaries are important. You know, setting up boundaries. And that's something that I do with all my, because I, you know, I teach fourth graders and I teach high school and I teach college. So it's like, you know, I know not to cuss for these classes, but I can cuss for these class. You know, it's just one of those. It's just code switching. I'm constantly code switching, but just boundaries. And then making sure, because one thing I've learned about class is it's the students that make it unsafe a lot of times when they're unsafe towards each other. So that's one of the big things is like, how do we treat everybody the way you want to be treated, you know, and make sure you're taking care of each other and taking care of yourself? Because I mean, I can remember leaving my social justice class. I left one. This was when COVID happened and COVID hit the dorms and one student said, so, you know, one student told everyone that they were the one that had COVID. So it shut everything down. So students were mad. I had to leave class early for an audition. So then one student was like, well, you know who you are. You got COVID and you gave everybody COVID. Now I have to go home and I'm gay and my parents don't know and I'm mad. I mean, it was just a whole bunch of stuff. And they, you know, they created an unsafe environment. And like I said, I wasn't there. There's two teachers in the room and I had left. And it was just like coming back to be like, hey, y'all, you have to take care of each other. I mean, I'm here as a professor, but in the end, I'm going to leave and y'all are in the dorms together. You know, y'all are going to go on for 4 years because you're undergrad with each other. So how do you navigate that? How do you make sure, even if you don't like somebody, that you can have a working relationship? Because you're going to be in a show with them. You're going to be in class with them. So, you know, we talk about all those things and how to foster those healthy interpersonal relationships and how to also keep your distance when you need to. Because I know I was in grad school. I didn't necessarily was comfortable with all my classmates. I mean, they showed me who they were. And when people show me who they are, I believe them, you know? So I'm like, you know, so we just, it's a lot of talking and unpacking constantly, all day, every day, you know, because we constantly have to, I'm always telling them we have to relearn, because the thing you learned first was probably some bullshit. So we need to relearn. You know, so we all have to relearn how to love each other no matter what, you know?
Yes. That's so wonderful that you make space for the students to talk. That is something I was just talking about with some classmates, that there's certain professors that talk at you for a long period of time and it doesn't help you learn. It's amazing. Sometimes they're geniuses and you wish you could engage well with what they're saying to you, but you can't because they're talking at you for so long. And that space to process what you're going through as a student is so valuable in becoming an artist.
I think the most important thing for all of us is, you know, we shouldn't, the abused shouldn't become the abuser. You know, I was abused by professors in that same talk at you, make you do meaningless shit, you know, and I always made sure I didn't want to do that to my students. Like, I don't make my students journal. I can't stand journal. I could not stand it. I just see some people don't. So I wanted, they're like, what? We don't have to journal. I'm like, no, I hated it. So I'm not, I also don't want to read your most I'm not that invasive, because I, you know, in grad school, like, oh, journal, tell how you feel. Like, no, this is, I don't need to tell you how I feel. That's none of your business. Mm-hmm. You know, like, literally, it's none of your business how I really feel. So I don't know. I try not to be like all those shit people that I had to deal with. You know,
what you're talking about is like changing the culture and that interpersonal relationship, which, you know, is so important. And I'm wanting there to be more systemic change so that it's not, that labor isn't just put on the teachers or directors.
And it tends to be, like y'all were saying, it's put on female bodies.
Yes.
You know, it's put on and even more Black bodies. Like they brought me into dinner, like, oh, we'll bring in the Black woman. You know, we got to bring in, you know, the non-binary Black woman to do this, mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, and nobody else is doing the work. You know, it's like, so it's just me talking with these kids and treating them like human beings. I mean, my class told me today, you know, we love you the most. And I was like, well, I love y'all more. Like, I win. I love y'all more. I have more love to give. I'm older. You know, but and I mean, I know why they love me, because I just allow them to be human. Mm-hmm. Most professors don't even allow you to be human. They don't, you know, like you said, they talk at you. They, you know, they don't allow any space. And as artists, we have to have space. As humans, it doesn't even matter if you're not an artist, you have to have space. You know, I'm getting emotional.
We're talking about these training programs, and higher education is truly supposed to be in preparing them for the professional workplace, then why are you preparing them to be silent and not creative and collaborators and strong, independent students who and individuals who take agency? You know, because we all know it's so crazy that they keep getting hired. But we all know that the directors that we really dislike, they're the ones that treat actors like props, or that create little pictures on stage and don't allow for the complexity and the whole person to be there and co-create with you. We all know those are the crap directors. Mm-hmm. So we have to start showing them during these education, during when they're learning this stuff and learning how this is supposed to look, that you get to be a co-creator.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really, a director is in a previous episode, I think Shalana put it that way too, that, you know, directors are facilitators. We're not dictators.
Yeah. You're supposed to be, right? But within that, within white supremacy in the theater, which is the theater, no, they're dictators most of the time. There's very few directors. I mean, shit, I can remember having a director. She made me knock on the door and say hello for 45 minutes because she wanted the pitch of my hello to be placed. I don't know where the fuck she wanted it. But for 45 minutes, hello.
That's
like, why? It's a knock on a door, a hello, you know? But, you know, I don't know. I always feel like it's a power thing. It's a power thing. Mm-hmm. And they know they have the power.
And an insecurity. You know, it's cliche for a reason that, you know, the people who have the least experience are the most arrogant. The directors that feel like they have to come in with this concept that must be fulfilled, that even if it doesn't end up working out, you know, that have to have it a certain way are usually the ones who aren't good or insecure and feel that they need to show that they are in power.
And they keep working. That's the bad thing. They keep getting more jobs.
Yeah. We're talking a lot about directors and actors, and this article focuses predominantly on acting training programs. What are your thoughts on students in directing or stage management, design, producing, or other areas? Have you given any thoughts to ways that you would want to approach those disciplines?
Yes. I think that there is a specific responsibility regarding the human body for directors, stage managers, producers, and costume designers specifically, that you are really at risk often of continuing the oppression that our society does to certain types of bodies. And I think that there needs to be an emphasis on teaching, how do you do research about cultures or experiences or bodies that you do not have an experience with? And then how do you speak up when or intervene when you see something going wrong? Like, that is a learned skill that those of us that are leaders should be teaching. That's a very important part of how to be a generous leader, which I think that's what directing and stage managing and producing is, and even designing a bit, is being a leader. And it's important that we learn, how do we research? How do we intervene? And how do we self-correct? Like, how do you feel embarrassed when you make a mistake, engage with that tricky emotion, and then move forward and continue on in a artistic practice that requires a lot of vulnerability. It's hard, and it's not talked about enough in my experience.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And something I've thought about is less segregation between the disciplines. You know, in professional world, it'd be great if directors weren't the only one to have information and communication with designers. And I think that would be great if it was emulated, beginning with education.
Yes.
Although I think that really does mean a different shift in model and ways of creating. And, you know, I can hear in my producer brain, like, well, financially, how do we afford to do that? I'm like, I don't know. We'll figure it out. but we got to figure it out, because all this is, we do have to relearn this.
Yes.
We do. Right. We have to redo it.
Have you ever seen an actor in a design meeting? But whose bodies and safeties are we talking about in design meetings?
Come on.
I've spent an hour in a meeting watching people talk about women's boobs in a design meeting. And she was nowhere in the room, like, about where to hide the knife in her boobs. Why are the actors never involved in these conversations? There can be so much learning. I've had one class where I was all disciplines. And we all learn so much from each other, but it's rare. They just think there isn't enough time.
Yeah, I would love to see a new way of collaborating with all the artists and disciplines. And also that mentality that we do need to focus on just one discipline. I don't know very many theater people who are just one thing. I listed four things at the beginning of this, and that's because I dropped off like five others.
Yeah. That's real. That's real.
I'm going to list a giant list.
Yeah.
So I would say that. And then something else in terms of curriculum that I think all theater makers needs to be taught: history, non-Eurocentric white history, and other areas of social sciences and the humanities. You know, we are in the business of gathering community to tell stories about people.
Yes. Yes.
In this desperate need of more critical thinkers who constantly question
who wrote the story, who benefits from the story, and who is missing from the story. And yeah. I think that means expanding our curriculums in terms of histories and the humanities. You know, theater history textbooks, and as you said, Konstantin Stanislavski is great, but Howard Zinn and bell hooks are better.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to make for better theater makers.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's my two cents on what everyone needs. What are some other things that you feel need to transform within higher education?
For me in higher education, I'm just literally like, fire all the white men. I can't front. I'm just at that point after working in education and hell, fire half of the white women too, because they're just as bad. They want to be the white men. I mean, that's just where I'm at. I'm down. I want to wipe the slate clean. I'm okay with throwing out the cannon. I'm okay with that. Let's just start over. There just comes a time when we just need to start over. I mean, no. Yeah. I mean, I like check off, but okay. I'm done with it now. I'm done. So that's, I know I'm very extreme. Yes. But I just think it's time for extreme measures, because these little breadcrumb things, this, all these letters, oh, we're going to do this. It's all bullshit. So we just got to start over. We got to wipe it and start over. That's where I'm at.
I'm there with you. Especially another thing I would add to that is getting rid of the compartmentalizing the boxes, this department, that department. Yeah. Oh, there can be that class on Latinx plays. There can be that class on queer theater, but we don't talk about that when we're in acting one.
Yeah. Okay. This makes no sense.
No sense.
It's no sense. But you know, they want to separate. They want us to all separate, you know, and that's the problem. If they keep us separated, then, you know, white supremacy can still reign. It can still, you know, it can still reign because we're separated.
I'm always the odd person out with the, like, the canceling. Every single time I'm on this podcast, I'm always the one that's like, well, I don't know if we need to cancel the whole thing.
We need people like you. We need you.
You made me read Hedda Gabler. I didn't want to, but it was assigned for my class. And I heard you say that you like love that show and you want to do it. And I was like, all right, I'll read it for you and for my assignment.
What did you think?
Wait, Hedda Gabler. That's the lady with the gun, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There's so many white plays in my head. They all kind of. You know, I gotta like get clarification. I've read them all, obviously.
I can see what you like about it. It wasn't for me, but I can like about it. It was a very emotional journey. I loved that.
I so feel her experience. I do. But, you know, I do recognize that as I've been told, I have an unhealthy ability to empathize with my oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. It's real. And I love Shakespeare. I do. I can't help it. Yeah. When I think about what I'd want to transform, I don't think that needs to go away. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with white theater. I don't know that I need to be a part of it. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. The issue is that there's just an overrepresentation of white narratives. I mean, the AIPAC report, the visibility report came out, you know, not too long ago. And, you know, the only group that is overrepresented over their population size are white folk. Mm-hmm. Only one, you know, so I'm not saying y'all need to go away, but maybe, you know, stick to your proportion. I think about, you know, Latinxes as the largest racialized group in this country at 3% representation. I mean, that's 18% of the total US population and 3% representation. Are you freaking kidding me?
Goodness.
That's what I'm saying, is like, there needs to be, we actually need things to be equal, equity, which, yeah. You know, that's where I'm at. And as far as like other things I'd like to see transformed in educational programs, I think the cultural competency, yes, let's do that. More integration of the humanities in the curriculum and desegregate these different disciplines. But also, we need more basic, tangible preparedness for the industry. You know, teach how to put together a resume, what to look for in a headshot, how to read a contract, how and when to negotiate pay, how to do a directing pitch. I still don't know how to do that as a director, 20 years in the industry. You know, how to put together a portfolio and professional website, how to advocate for what you need. And for fuck's sake, can we please stop pretending like colorblind casting is somehow less harmful in education, as if that isn't stunting them to think critically about race? Mm. And instead of assuming that every student gets a mentor to speak these unspoken rules of the industry, you know, let's prepare them to be successful global thinkers.
Amen. Yes.
And that's my TED Talk.
I'm here
yes.
for it.
Yes.
So with that, to close out, I'll ask question, what is one piece of advice you would give to the students, artists in training, or future leaders of the theater industry?
My piece of advice is to chase after spaces where you can creatively be authentic to yourself. Because no one told me that. And that is something I had to learn the hard way after spending 4 years in education in a place that I had to be someone I wasn't. And I couldn't be queer. I couldn't be too brown. I couldn't be too non-binary or too feminine. I had to fit into their box. And I lost so much time in my ability to grow. And that's what I think training and education is for, is growing. And there are spaces where you're going to find that you can be in community with people that accept you. So when you find those spaces, latch onto them, do all the learning, do all the hard work, because that is where you're going to thrive. But until you get there, like, try and find your space where you can be, even if it's a small club that you make yourself of a few friends, and that becomes your school. Make your school where you can succeed and be yourself in creativity.
That's great advice. My advice is don't be afraid to burn a bridge. You know, don't be afraid to set it on fire, mm-hmm. burn it up, stomp on the ashes. Because I think a lot of times what I've found teaching and what I've even found with myself, we take abuses for no reason because we think we're supposed to, especially actors. Actors are taught that, oh, yeah, let the director abuse you. I should have walked off stage when she made me knock for 45 minutes. I should have said bye. You know, now I would have. I mean, I did a show pre-pandemic. I completely quit. I called Equity. I was like, yo, this is unsafe. It's messed up. Let them know that I quit because I'm not. I'm just too old. I'm too old and I don't want to age myself. Stress ages you. Okay. I am almost 40. It's right there. It's next door. So, you know, don't be afraid to burn a bridge. Follow that gut and sometimes, yeah, burn that bridge because somebody, there'll be another one to be built. There'll be another one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's, I just want to.
Go ahead.
I want to highlight, follow your gut, you just said. That's so important. It's so hard when you're young to like, do I know anything yet? You're in this place where there's so many people older than you, but you got it.
The gut will tell you. It will tell you. You know, I always say that is your ancestors.
Yes. That's the
people before you talking to you like, hey, nah, sis, nah, bruh, nah, them, nah, hell mm-hmm. nah. You know, so yeah. And then if you have to, burn that bridge.
Yeah. I recently heard Lavina Jadwani, who's...
Lavina. Yes, I know Lavina.
Oh, I don't know her personally, but I definitely admire her. And she wrote this article, I don't know if you saw it, on HowlRound about identity conscious casting. That was fantastic. Everyone should go and read that. It was incredible. Yeah, and she's probably the first woman of color directors I've seen who kind of sounds like me. And I mean that literally. you know, she's passionate and speaks her mind and sometimes speaks way too fast when she's enthusiastic about something. And obviously I do that too. And, you know, as well as laugh at my own jokes and giggle. But it's, you know, it's inspiring to see a young woman of color being uncensored, which is, you know, probably why I like the show, the Mindy Project. Mm. And of course, Insecure, because they challenge stereotypes, but the main characters weren't adhering to the pressure society puts on women of color to, you know, only speak when you have something important to say and to speak eloquently and concisely. So I admire Jadwani. But when I recently heard her speak, she was asked a question about
similar to this, what piece of advice she would give to students who are about to join the workforce. And she said, be a gracious guest. And man, I was so bummed by that answer. Again, in her defense, like it was probably put on the spot and like, you know, there's probably some truth to that. Her career is, you know, she's been doing okay for a reason. But, you know, to me, it was just such a bummer because I don't think like what kind of what both of you are saying, you know, I think the students shouldn't feel even more pressure to toe the line. Yeah. And never challenge the status quo. I mean, yes, of course, be gracious, be respectful. Absolutely. But it's okay to rock the boat, especially if there's a damn hole in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I've had a bit of time to think about what I wish she had said. And my piece of advice is to allow your moral compass to guide you, not someone else's idea of what success is supposed to look like. And also, to be uncompromising in your ethics.
Come on.
So, with that, are there any upcoming events or resources you want to make listeners aware of?
Yes, I have a resource I'm excited about. It is an article. Since we're talking about higher education, we should talk about the people it serves. This is written by a young person in college, and the article is Trans in College Musical Theater: How Can I Hope for a Future That I Don't See? And it's by Dan Eggers, published on the Buckeye Flame. And it's just a great article he wrote about his experience being the first transgender student entering a top musical theater program in this country. And he has some great questions in this article about the future going forward. And I really recommend reading this article.
And I will be continuing the discussion on reclaiming and reshaping higher education as a guest speaker along with Lisa Channer for the University of Minnesota's event, Shaking Up the Classics. Channer and I will be discussing approaches, processes, and philosophies underpinning adaptations of Greek, Spanish Golden Age, and other classics. We will be defining the term classical, discussing how to redefine the term in a way that challenges oppressive ideologies such as white supremacy and patriarchy. We will talk about what classical often means for BIPOC artists, and how we can better serve and amplify the voices of the historically marginalized on the American stage. The event will take place at 5:30 Central Standard Time on Friday, April 23rd. For a Zoom link, please visit the U of M Theater Arts and Dance event page. I will also post a link on our Facebook page.
Also, if you have not already done so, please go back and listen to our special episode, Honoring AAPI Communities. During the episode, we amplify statements of several Asian American organizations in response to the increasing acts of hate against AAPI communities. We also share resources and provide ways to support. Accessible links can be found on our Facebook page. All right. Thanks, y'all.
Yeah.
Thanks again for tuning in. To stay up to date on episodes, you can subscribe on the platform you are currently listening to. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at TCP Theater Podcast. And we really appreciate your reviews, comments, or questions. You can reach us via email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com or through our social media. Thank you for listening to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater with
Alex Reed,
Ana Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria Carrera,
Lilia Hushman,
Lupika Shah,
Oogie Push,
Saimuk Da Duompusai Vongsai,
Sequoia Hawk,
Shalana Wanch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Vahishta Vafadari,